All right. Of course, Mickey and I both have a series of slides from a man named Richard Thetford that does these outlines for this particular book with the permission of Bob and Sandra Waldron. And but the thing is that Mickey has a tendency to modify those slides, so I have no idea what he might have done for either Lesson 9 or Lesson 10. But as we look at Lesson 9, we see that Lesson 9, we were starting off with the beginning of Genesis. Okay, so Lesson 9, I think, was titled Genesis like 1 through 12 or something like that. Genesis 1 through 11. And then Lesson 10, which would be the lesson before Lesson 11, is labeled Genesis 11:27 through 25:10. And it has to do with the patriarchs. Mickey said that he was going to bring up the stuff about Genesis 12, where we have the promises and also the things that that have to do with the dispersion of the people and the lineage of Christ. So we'll see how this goes. So if I seem a bit flustered, you'll know why. I've had zero preparation time for any of this. So the thing we want to understand is, of course, that as we sit here in the United States, as a matter of fact, if you want to, we can zoom right in here on where we are right now, and we can see that here we are, right here at the church building, and you can see yourselves seated in the pews right there, even though nobody's bothered to drive a car here, so I guess everybody walked. But anyway, but just remember, though, that when we're talking about the area that we just zoomed in on, that it's hugely bigger than the area that we've been talking about over here in what I've just nominally labeled the Bible lands. Okay? And let me turn all that junk off. And so the area that we're talking about is something that's just a whole lot smaller than what we're ever used to. Yet, when we look at it, it is responsible for a good majority of the world's history. Seems to me, as I was going through, scanning through Lesson 10, there was it was on the bottom of page 40, but I guess that's not what I was thinking about. But there's a italicized thing at the bottom of page 40 that the entire remaining portion of the Bible is the story of the fulfillment of these three promises: the nation, the land, and the one who would bless all nations. And really, that's true. When we look at that, and we look at these. We look at these Bible lands that are up here, we realize that the salvation of all mankind is dependent on a single man who traveled not much further than in this area right here his entire life. And he has impacted all of us in everything that we do, even those people who don't want to believe. Those people who believe in a different God, they still have been impacted by that. Everybody, of course, as we know, just about, uses the same calendar that we do. We discussed that a couple of weeks ago about the fact that we've got, B.C. and A.D. and all that sort of stuff, and all that is predicated around what? The birth of Christ. Okay, so B.C., of course, is a later term, meaning before Christ, and then A.D., of course, was penned by that guy with the funny name back in the 1700s, who came up. Pardon? Dionysius Exiguus. Very good. I knew you'd both get it. So Dionysius Exiguus back in, okay, so what was the date? All right. I want to say it was in the 1700-somethings. But anyway, when he coined the term Anno Domini. Now, he had an agenda that wasn't, let's make a calendar that everybody's going to use for the rest of their lives. He had an agenda to date the premillennial coming. That was his agenda behind all this. But what he did was he ended up showing, essentially, that in his calendar anyway, that the Christ was born at 0 AD. It turns out now, because of assumptions on his part and assumptions on other people's part, it appears that if we look at today's calendar, he was born between, what, 2 and 4 BC, something like that. So so some of our reckonings are off based on the calendar that we use today, but not based on, you know, not based on biblical things. So this was just something that some guy put together. All right. If we go, if we look through, I listened to the end of Mickey's stuff on lesson 9, and there was something, let me see if I have this on here. I just wanted to show you this one chart that you've got all, that you've all got in your book anyway. But there's, one of these is 9. So we'll figure out which one it is. If I can get it to work. 7, 6, 8, 9. All right. So as we look down through here to the end of 9, you'll remember that there's this chart in the book that talks about how everybody was dispersed from the time of Noah, and that Noah had these three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and who came of this and who came of that. Eventually, of course, of the people of Ham came the sort of the bane of the Israelites, the Philistines, and and then through Shem came all of these other people, Assyria, and so on, and then through Japheth came all of the other peoples. Anyway, so we see that after the flood, the world was populated then by these folks and their descendants. All right, and as we pass, as we go then into lesson 10, and we look at it's not Genesis 10. The software and I are not getting along together today. No, we're going to Genesis 11, rather, starting at about verse 27. We see now that what we're talking about has to do with generational map that we just looked at. And so we have a genealogy in Genesis 11 that we're just looking at the tail end of right here. And, of course, it's not until we get to Nahor that we really see people that we remember, that he begat Terah, and Terah begat Abram, Nahor, which is his grandson, and Haran, or Haran. So Abram, Nahor, and Haran then are what? Brothers, okay? And Abram was later named Abraham. And what happened to Nahor? I think he died. Tira died in Haran. Okay, so they were all commanded, of course, as they were living in the Ur of the Chaldees, to move to the city that later got the name of Haran or Haran. Notice that it says that Haran died before his father Tira in the land of his nativity in the Ur of the Chaldees. So if we go back over here to Google Maps, or Google Earth rather, and we zoom out a little bit, we look at the Ur of the Chaldees, we realize that the Tigris and Euphrates rivers are over here in this area, and Ur of the Chaldees is in this area here, at the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, as I recall. Might have been in between them in the more fertile area. But anyway, they were commanded by God to leave the Ur of the Chaldees and travel up here to Haran, which, of course, because the families that moved up there were fairly powerful families, they named it after Abram's brother, Haran. And so they lived there for a while. And then if we go back here and look at so Haran died before they moved, and then Abram and Nahor they moved, and I said they went forth with them from the Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan, and they came to Haran and dwelt there. In the days of Tira were 205 years, and Tira died in Haran. So Tira, of course, was the daddy, and he died there in Haran. And so now the people that are left, of course, that should be the daddy. Of course, I notice one of his sons' name is Tira also. Or no, it's Nahor. That's right. Sorry. I got the grandfather mixed up here. But anyway, so the daddy died after they came to Haran, and so Abram and Nahor were there in Haran, and they were then commanded to head out for another place. They were on there. They were told to go on their way to Canaan. Let's see if I can bring up the right slideshow here. I don't know. Look at it again here. All right, so Abram and Nahor took wives. Sarai, the name of Nahor, is Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. Sarosia and Tira, so that's the daddy, took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, and his sons, and they went forth with them. I knew that. So, yeah. So anyway, so what's his name stayed there? Nahor, right? Yeah, so many names here. Anyway, so Nahor stayed there. So Tira, the dad, and Abram went, and he brought with him his wife, and he also brought with him his nephew, Lot. And they went to Haran. And then Tira stayed there in Haran, and when he was 205 years old, he died. Sure. Isn't there a map in here that shows Haran? It shows it. Oh, okay. It shows it way up at the top of. All right. So, if this map here is anything like what we've got in the book, it's showing it, yeah, just sort of northwest of Cyprus. So that area right there, if I turn on borders and labels right now, let's see what country that's in. That's in Syria now. Okay, so that's where Haran is, and it looks like it's right on the Euphrates River, well, pretty much on the Euphrates River. So they went from Ur of the Chaldees, which was way down here, way down here in Iraq, by the Euphrates River, and they moved all the way up here to Haran. Now, they did this, according to the Bible, on the way to Canaan. Why did they do that on the way to Canaan, since, obviously, it's a quicker route to just go right across here? We've discussed this, haven't we? Yeah, some rough terrain. It's all very bleak desert, and what was it that we had just to the east of the land of Israel? Big lava beds. So bad places to travel in, especially when the temperature is up at 190 degrees, you know. So if you've ever driven between here and the Colorado River during the summer and seen the lava beds there, you think, boy, I hope my air conditioner does not go out because it's just not good. And my understanding was that their air conditioners weren't as good as ours. Melissa. Right. They had to take all their herds and everything. And so if they had across the desert here, they got nothing. So very little water even. There are some occupied areas in this area. So you can see, for example, here there's a few small mountains and things like that. My understanding is that in that particular area there are at least some vegetation and towns and things like that. And if we were to zoom in on that, we'd see that indeed that at this time that there are little villages. But most of the people that live in areas like this is, what do we call them today? Besides crazy? The Bedouin, right? So Bedouin just go from like oasis to oasis, herding their goats and giving them a place to eat, and then move on to the next place, I guess. Much like the wilderness wanderings, I guess. So I'm unclear as to why they do that, but that's their way of life. All right. Let me turn borders off again. Yes, I do have a place on there with your name on. I could zoom in on your house if I wanted to. So, okay. do what? Oh, yeah. I better turn this thing off so nobody looks at it. Trying to maximize this thing. It doesn't want to maximize for some reason. So, okay. What was I talking about? I have no idea. Okay. so, Abram then was commanded by God to get out of his country and from his father's house and go to a land that he would show him. He says, and in chapter 12 is where we have probably one of the most famous passages in the Bible. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and be thou a blessing, and I will bless them that bless thee, and him that curseth thee will I curse, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So Abram went as Jehovah had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. So what do we gather from Genesis chapter 12? What promises are those? And, yeah. Nation, land, and Savior. So we can look at these things. he says, go to a land that I'll show thee. I'll make of thee a great nation. I'll bless thee, make thy name great, and thou be thou a blessing. Bless them that bless thee, curse them that curse thee. And thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. This is really the genesis, you might say, of the promise of the Messiah. It says, of thee I will bless all the families of the earth. And so we see here that in chapter 12, the promises that we've sort of lived on for many, many years now are started right here. Now, they're mentioned here to Abram. To whom else are they mentioned? Isaac. And I believe Jacob. So I think that each time that the generation passed on to the next person, this same similar type of promise was given. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and what was Jacob later renamed? Israel. Okay. All right. Let me see if this leads us anywhere down to where Mickey might have wanted us to be at. So we're looking at the promises to Abraham, and we've just looked at Genesis 11:27, and we haven't gone all the way to 25:10 yet, but we realize that this time was about 2000 B.C. Now, to fix this right now. So this was about 2000 B.C. that there were many nations already in existence at that time. I'm bound and determined to get this thing to work, so we'll give it a try. that many nations had already risen and fallen by the time that we get to this 2000 B.C. when approximately it was that this call went out to Abraham, to Abram, that by this time Egypt, the pyramids had been built, and Egypt was already being ruled by its 12th dynasty. So it wasn't like what we were talking about was just an unpopulated earth. And Abram was going around and his descendants were just going to completely populate the earth. But what they did was they affected the entire earth. But it's interesting to see the thing. So he's got a little doohickey here that shows the pyramids, and we need to remember that by the time that Abraham was making his movement from Ur of the Chaldees to Haran down to Canaan, that the pyramids were had already been built. Some others were still in the process of being built. All right. So now, in the world of the patriarchs, then we want to identify some of the places that are in here because we see them referred to from time to time in the biblical text. So in the biblical text we have the land of Sumer mentioned, okay? Not Summer, Sumer. So Sumer, of course, is down here, way down, essentially where they started off. Essentially the Ur of the Chaldees was down there. Ur of the Chaldees simply means that it was a town and that the Chaldeans lived there. That's all that means. But that was the early area that you'll see. So if you see the word Sumer in the Bible, you'll see that you'll remember that it was sort of at the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. That's where Sumer was. Then we have another city or another area mentioned in the Bible that's called Elam, and we can see that Elam was over to the east of those rivers. And as I recall, I just lost their names. Adam and Eve had Cain and Abel, yes. So Cain killed Abel, right? So as I recall, when Cain moved, he moved over here to Elam. He moved over to the east of where supposedly the Garden of Eden was, which we assume is in this area somewhere, but what has God said about the location of the Garden of Eden? He hasn't said anything about it, so we don't know where it is. And so we can go to, is it Ezekiel? The hidden thing? No, Deuteronomy. I have it marked in my Bible, the hidden things of God, the secret things of God. 29:29. So Deuteronomy 29:29 says, "The secret things belong unto Jehovah our God, but the things that are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law." It's important for us to realize that if God did not consider it important for us to know something, he didn't tell us about it. So it doesn't do us any good to try and find the Garden of Eden, or down here to find Sodom and Gomorrah, or to look for Mount Ararat and find the Ark, or to go to Area 51 and find the Ark of the Covenant. You know, it's like, it's just not going to happen. God didn't want us to do that. It wasn't important. Another area that God talked about, or that is mentioned in in Scripture, is the area of Akkad, and that's here. Also between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers and what later became known as Babylonia. And so you'll remember that we have some discussion in the Bible about the Akkadians. Yes, David. Yeah. Yes. As a matter of fact, if we both recall correctly, Sumer was an area of learning and education. And as a matter of fact, when we come across cuneiform tablets, I believe it was here at Sumer in this area, they found this huge library of cuneiform tablets that helped them, much like the Rosetta Stone helped us to translate Egyptian hieroglyphics, helped us to translate early languages into something that we can make sense of. The interesting thing is that if they live here in Ur of the Chaldees, they were essentially in Sumer, and so they were in an area that sort of by default was an educational area to begin with. Ken, did you have a discussion?
Yeah.
Well, we'll just find out, I guess. Yeah, it's in Iraq, right? Did I turn everything off? I did. Let's see. Borders and labels. So here's Iran right here, and here's Iraq. So it looks to me like the border between Iran and Iraq goes right up one of the rivers, or no, is it one of the rivers, or maybe there's a mountain range. Anyway, this is the border between Iran and Iraq. The rivers are here. There's one here, and there's one here. So it looks like Iraq has both the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. So Sumer would, keep looking in the wrong place. Let me look here. Sumer would have been between the two rivers, and so would have been sort of in Iraq and maybe in Iran at this time. Okay, you'll remember that in recent world history we've heard about the city Basra quite a bit. Okay, I think that there were a number of battles that occurred in the town of Basra, and so that would have been somewhere in the area of where Ur of the Chaldees might have been. I'm not seeing when it comes down to Sumer or something like that anything really addressing that. You can see the confluence of the two rivers right here coming together, and Sumer would have been up in this area. Dikar, that's what they're calling it in this particular area, the town of Amara and the town of Nasiriyah. So a lot of our history, early history, takes place in what now is called Iran, but mostly in Iraq. David. I would think so. Yeah. Right.
And then God told Abraham to leave this, and he wasn't living in a tent when he found it, when he left. Yeah. I think their buildings were probably coming along there.
It's certainly possible. I'm not sure what the living conditions were in those areas, but generally speaking, like you say, in agricultural areas, people don't live in mobile units. They live in something that's pretty stable. When we look at the Native Americans of the Southwest, when we look at the ones we call hunter-gatherers, they moved from place to place. But then later on, the people that later on became called the Anasazi, they started making permanent dwellings. The thing is that I think in their instance they found out that unfortunately they made permanent dwellings in what later on turned out to be an unfortunate place, because apparently they suffered such a severe drought that they had to leave over hundreds of years, type thing. Not like we've had over the last 5 or 6 years, but you're right. They were told to leave a fertile area. This whole area up here is fertile, and there was an interesting, and we'll get into this later, you know, about 40 lessons down here when we're talking about Babylon and Assyria and stuff like that. But one of the towns, Babylon, wherever it is here, I think was right on, like on the Euphrates River, or on the Tigris, one or the other. But the interesting thing is that the river passed through the city. In other words, they built the city on both sides, and then to make it a real cool city, they had this river running through the middle, so people could go down to the, you know, enjoy the river and things like that. Well, later on, when the Persians decided that they liked this area better than they liked that area, and came over and attacked, I guess it was Babylon, what they did was they just went upriver a bit and they stopped the river. And when they did that, they could just walk in the riverbed right into the city. So it was a fatal mistake by the Babylonians, assuming I'm remembering this correctly. But so that's where we are. And so he's moving from this fertile area, but he's been told to move to an area where I'm telling you to move to. But as we've mentioned, he didn't of course just foolishly just walk straight across the desert. You know, he didn't do that. Apparently everybody knew that wasn't the way to go. And so he just followed the rivers, went up here, and so this is still the Euphrates River here, and that's where Haran was right about there. And so he's just following the fertile area all the way up. Of course, he's got his sheep and goats and cattle and whatever that they had with him. And he was a fairly wealthy man. As a matter of fact, by the time they moved down to here and had been in the land of Canaan for a while, he was quite the wealthy man. So wealthy that he and Lot had to do what? They had to split up because it just wasn't enough land for both of their herds to do. So wait a minute, there's a hand in the middle of my picture. I have that. all right. What was I talking about? I don't know. Oh, we were identifying various cities or places in this area. So as we go back then and look at some of these others, because and the reason that we bring these up is because these things are things that have been mentioned in the biblical text as we read through Genesis chapters 11 and 12. So you remember that we mentioned that there were the Akkadians that lived in this area. Now, I think what the author of these slides is trying to point out is that when Abram and Terah and family left Ur of the Chaldees and went up through this area, which was still apparently a very fertile area, they had to pass through the holdings of a lot of people. And a lot of times, people weren't particularly willing to let these people pass through. So we had to realize that they just didn't get on a train and get on the sleeper car and wake up when they got to Haran. I mean, I didn't map this out to see how far that is, but that's as they say in Kentucky, a fur piece. Did it say in the book how far that is? About 600? It looks like it? Oh, yeah. Well, they have cryptically labeled Abraham's route right down here, so, okay. Anyway, pardon? Okay. Also, we realize that Babylonia was a sort of a nation that was sort of in its foundational time at that time. Later on, we get to hear about it a lot more, Jenny. So a 1,000-mile walk would have taken them at least a couple of days. So 600 miles then to go from Ur up to Haran, where they stayed for a number of years, if I get this correctly, until God finally told Abram, he says, pretty much, I told you to go somewhere else, and this is not where I told you to go. So anyway, he ends up coming down here to Shechem. But so 600 miles, and when we think about it, we're talking about our families, and you'll remember when the two twins that were born, Jacob and Esau, those people. You remember that when Jacob went back up here to get a wife, but had done nasty things to his brother down here in Israel by taking away his brother's birthright and all that sort of stuff, that you'll remember when that they were coming down from here down back into the land of Canaan, that they were talking about how laborious their progress was because they had their wives and their little ones and they had their flocks and their herds and their things like this. So they weren't making, they weren't getting on the freeway and doing 70 miles an hour. If you made with something like that 10 miles in a day, you were probably doing good. If you look at the people that came out here in covered wagons from the east, just coming out to the southwest, they were in wagons pulled by oxen and things like that, but they still had people that were walking and riding horses and such like as that. My understanding is that a good day for them was 20 miles, right? So we do 20 miles in 20 minutes. But for them, that was an entire day's walk. So 600 divided by 10 is carry the 9 and divide by 3, and it's 60. Yeah, roughly 60-somethings. So at least a couple of months to go there. I would say probably more. they had a good hike to go. So, and they were going through these other areas, but apparently they had fodder for their beasts and stuff like that, at least on the way. And then, for some reason, we're bringing up Egypt now, and we all know where Egypt is, but it doesn't have anything to do with the story that we're talking about right now, except for the fact that we want to point out that the Egyptian kingdom was already in existence at that time, and it was not a young kingdom at that time. As it was mentioned, they were already in their 16th dynasty, as the British would say. So they, and each dynasty did not have just one king. It had several kings. So a dynasty changed when the family changed. And so when, you know, King, when Pharaoh so-and-so got killed by somebody from another family and their family took over, then that was another dynasty. And by the time that we're talking about Ramesses in the time of Moses, I think the book has already mentioned some, he was like in the 20-something dynasty by that time. Quite a number of dynasties. So anyway, so really what we're trying to point out is that these other kingdoms already exist. It's not a completely unpopulated world that he's traveling through. And of course, the land of Canaan is where they were intending to head for. And then, what's his other one? Mari. And so that was another one they had to go through on the way up to Haran. And then finally, Nineveh, which is a place that we hear about in, where do we first hear about Nineveh? Maybe it's not the first time, in the book of Job, okay? So Job was told to go to Nineveh, and Jonah, Job had boils, and you should have known that. Jonah was told to go cry against Nineveh, and so in order to get to Nineveh, the first thing he did was jump on a ship and head for Spain. So I'm thinking it would have taken him a long time to get to Nineveh. So he was convinced otherwise that he should go to Nineveh, and he did that, which, as you can see, is probably as far from the coast to here as it is from here to Canaan, so maybe 400 miles. So Jonah had quite a ways to walk from the beach where the big fish spit him out to get to Nineveh to cry against Nineveh. Why didn't he want to cry against Nineveh to make them repent? He didn't like them. Exactly. They were the enemies of Israel. He knew through prophecy what was going to happen to Israel because of Nineveh. And he didn't want them to repent. He wanted God to bring, you know, fire and brimstone down upon them. And that's what his problem was. So as we go through here and follow Abraham's route from Ur to Haran, we realize that he's going through a lot of places that we've read about through the Bible and a lot of places that have a lot of history in them. Juan.
I think it's pretty weird actually going through all of this that, I mean, you kind of think about it when you hear about the flood and that everything had to start from somewhere because of the flood, but it's weird that like the Egyptian kingdom, when you talk about that, how they had the same exact lineage as everybody else, and yet they just started worshiping the sun god and all this other stuff, but you still got other families that are still, you know, talking to God, so it's kind of exciting.
You'd think. But go ahead, John, make your comment. And I think of when Jesus was one side of the Sea of Galilee, and he'd done a miracle, and he had fed the 4,000 or 5,000 or whatever. And then he crossed just a little over and went to Capernaum on the other side. And the people that had been there, that had seen this miracle, that had partaken of the bread and the fish that he said, they said, "What doest thou to show us that you're the Son of God?" And go, "What? Were you not here yesterday?" You know? It's like, it's just, it's incredible the things that go on. And so, yeah, but it is. I mean, we had we had a sort of a baseline, and they just seem to have just sort of diverged from that. Joey? Yeah. Yeah.
You can show them glaring evidence, and they go, yeah, but show me something I can believe.
In the rich man and Lazarus, what did the rich man say would happen if a dead person walked into the house of his brethren? They would believe. And Jesus says, no, that Moses and the prophets are preached to them every week in the synagogue, and they still don't believe. So, yeah, it's still.
And back to the point with Jonah going to Nineveh, he basically was hoping that they wouldn't repent because he wanted to see them destroyed.
He wanted to see Nineveh destroyed, yeah.
He reiterated in the New Testament that God's plans have not be our enemy. He said, pray for them, even pray for those who persecute you. So we're not supposed to have this idea, I hope God kills him or kills them. We're not
Yeah, it's amazing when you read through the Old Testament and compare it to the New Testament, just how many principles of the Old Testament are principles of the New Testament also, and were actually things that we just should have been doing the whole time anyway. All right, so next time we'll take up wherever it is that we left off, wherever this might be.